91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. The Downtown History Miami Museum houses more than 1 million historic images and 30,000 three-dimensional artifacts. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. You can see a 1920s trolley car, gold and silver recovered from the 17th and 18th century shipwrecks, artifacts from Pan American World Airways, and rafts that brought refugees to Miami. This afternoon, we profile South Florida's homegrown History Miami CEO and President, George Zamanillo. What's surprising is that outsiders are often surprised by the rich history of Miami and South Florida. We know better, of course. Stay tuned. Topical Currents and History Miami up next after the news. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with today's Topical Currents. This hour we visit with the President and CEO of History Miami, George Zamanillo. He's first joined the organization as curator in the year 2000 and became CEO just a few months back.
The History Miami Museum in downtown Miami's Cultural Center is greatly expanded, doubled in fact, and it's the premier cultural institution preserving the area's significant history. We'll learn much more about current events at the museum as well as what's ahead and how he plans to keep it thriving in the digital age.
He's quite conscious of preserving our history amid rapid development, redevelopment projects, of course, and collecting imperative artifacts. Welcome to you, George Zamanillo.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. I was reflecting on the fact that Miami is a city that epitomizes change and growth almost constantly, be it for better or for worse, and sometimes both. So as the director and CEO of History Miami, how challenging is it to keep pace with the changes because they are constant?
They are. You know, Miami is defined by epic moments or big events, it seems like, compared to other cities. I've been here since the 70s, and I've witnessed many of them, you know, either immigration or crime waves, whatever it may be. And I feel over the past 10 years, we've made an effort to make sure that we're out there in the community collecting and documenting those changes.
Tremendous amount of photographs and other visuals in the museum, millions.
Yeah, that's one of our strengths, really. We've always had a great collection of photographs from the Miami Herald and the Miami News, photojournalists across decades documenting South Florida. But lately, we've seen that extra push to really preserve those photographs, especially with digital age. Everyone has a phone on them. Everyone is snapping pictures all day, but rarely do they print them, and rarely do they back them up or store them.
Right.
So now we have the issue. It's like, how do we preserve and save those moments? So it's going to be a challenge, but we're looking at ways to do that.
You know what I was wondering? With the new immigration policies that are probably going to be in place, have you given thought or worried about the fact that we may not be seeing the same influx of immigrants in the future, who in your view have been largely responsible for shaping Miami's history and History Miami?
It is a possibility. You know, we have a great collection of wooden boats and rafts that have come in over the years from Haiti and Cuba that form part of our maritime collection. And we've been on the streets recently documenting those rallies and protests and the death of Castro, and making sure we're not only photographing the moment, but collecting artifacts on the streets. So we are concerned what's going to happen now with the changes to the wet foot, dry foot policy,
right,
and other policy changes in Cuba. How is that going to affect those immigration
waves? And elsewhere.
And elsewhere across the nation. Yes.
So you're making archival prints of digital photographs?
We will when we need to, either for an exhibit or when a customer or someone requests it for research or to purchase. But we are backing up and saving those photographs.
In a standard photographic way.
Definitely, yeah.
What does it mean to be a Smithsonian affiliate?
Well, it's a great partnership. There's a certain number of museums across the nation that the Smithsonian takes in as an affiliate, as a partner, and we're one of them. And it opens up many channels and communication, not only between the national museums and us, partnerships between other museums and maybe working on an exhibit. And they could borrow from us, and we can borrow from them. And it opened up those channels just to talk to people and curators and directors over there.
Have they taken anything recently, or have you taken anything from them recently?
Definitely. They're in the process right now of borrowing one of our large models of Pan Am, one of the Pan Am planes.
Oh.
They're doing a large immigration exhibition that they believe opens next year, and they wanted to borrow one of those planes because, of course, Pan Am was one of the premier airlines that helped facilitate that wave of immigrants coming in from Cuba.
And you've seen such growth in the size and scope of the museum in all the years you've been there. Is it a dream come true to now be the director and the CEO? Is this something you always wanted to do?
It really is great. You know, I started as an archaeologist, and I would come over to visit the museum and see the collections and the pieces that we were bringing in from the field. And then when I first came in 2000 as a curator, I got to use those materials and put them on exhibit and interpret them and do research based on what I found in the field. So now that I could actually craft the vision and chart the direction that we want to take the museum in and all the different things we want to do, it is an honor.
How is it determined what's historic, what's an artifact, and what isn't? Who makes the decisions?
Yeah.
What are the ground rules?
Sure. Well, it's mostly our curators and our staff. It depends on what they need for their research, what objects come in that document a certain event, like we mentioned before, in immigration. Or it could be something that's 10,000 years old that was found on the ground and documents the first Pueblo Indians that lived in the Deering Estate today. It could be a variety of things. But it really is about the power of an object. And that could be the power of a photograph that documents a moment. It can only capture it in that one time. Or the power of an object where it could tell a story, a real deep and emotional story maybe, or a more powerful story on the age of the prehistoric people that lived here 10,000 years ago. So it could be a variety of things.
You yourself are a photographer, I understand. Do you use a real camera and you use real film? And
you need a CDS light meter?
Yeah.
I don't do film anymore. I'm an amateur photographer. I did some film when I was in field school for archaeology and when I was documenting sites, archaeological sites in South Florida. But mostly now it's all digital.
It's all digital.
Yeah.
So what is your vision? I mean, I read some of you have their new approaches to collecting exhibitions, the overall look and design of the museum. Expand on those approaches and how they're new.
Yeah, for us, I noticed a big change over the past 3 or 4 years. You know, we expanded our spaces, and the former Miami Art Museum space now is our south building. We have two buildings that we operate, and that gave us the opportunity to more than double our programming space. So now we have 2 or 3 exhibitions at a time on the floor instead of one, and that provides many opportunities to the ways we interpret materials, the way we form partnerships in the community and let other people bring in their ideas and exhibits. So it's been a great opportunity.
What are your current exhibits right now?
Right now we're working on an exhibition that opens tomorrow called Memory Lab, mm-hmm. and that's a collaboration between the Wolfson Media Archives and Obsolete Media Miami. And it's a great partnership because we're using artists to... We're handing over a gallery. It's a laboratory. And these artists are exploring the concept of memory. And they're doing their own installations. I think it's about 16 different artists and 4 collaborations. About 20 artists are taking over the space. And it's been a very positive response. I think we have over 700 people that RSVP'd for the opening tomorrow.
Wow. So yeah. What would that look like, though? I mean, we have that show on NPR, Memory Lab,
right.
Which is a great show. But so what's that going to look like? How are you exploring the memory?
So each artist has a kind of a free-for-all. They could do whatever they want using our archives, though. They're using our archives, the moving picture archives from Wolfson, and using objects. And it's their interpretation of Miami and the memories. So you have different video installations. You have a hands-on installation for some of them. Objects from our collection that interpret certain ways. So it's really about having 20 different curators interpreting memory.
That's going to be fun.
That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Tell us more about the education outreach that you have. It seems that you really need to have young people be interested in history to keep things alive here.
Definitely. That's where it starts. You know, your first exposure to history in South Florida, and that usually happens when they're in third or fourth grade, and they first visit the museum as a fourth grade Florida history class. But that is also a challenge we're working on. You know, when we first started doing that program in the 80s, there was only one place you could really visit, one or two museums. Now you have many museums across right. South Florida, we're fortunate to have that, but there's many more opportunities. So we not only bring people into the museum, but we have outreach. We go to the schools, we go to historic sites, and we do the city tours, and we do different programs.
So they do field trips, the school classes?
Definitely do field trips, yeah. So there's many ways to reach kids.
Is it difficult to take them into a static museum setting? I know a lot of these things are user friendly, but these kids are looking for virtual reality or something. And
yeah, it's quite amazing. You know, we always think about that these days, because every kid has a phone, they have a small computer in their hands,
right,
and they have all the information they want, right, the touch of their fingertips. But when you show them the real thing and the real object, and they see something that is amazingly old for them.
By the way, kids, an actual raft that went 90 miles
right
through rough
and you
seas.
Tell that, right, and you show that raft that came with seven men that looks like it's made out of fence boards and cloth. And you tell them how incredible it was they got here in shark-infested waters, and they got picked up by a freighter, and the raft washed up. And then later on, the man saw his raft on display, and we got to meet him, interview him, get his story. That still communicates. That still connects to the visitor.
I see you've served on local historic preservation boards, including the Historic and Environmental Preservation Board for the City of Miami. So what are your feelings about, if you'd like to share them, the development that's happening in Miami?
Well, just like our history, it's all in waves, right? So I was on the board in the 2000s a couple of times, and we did see the major changes and the condos going up in South Florida and the housing developments out west. But it's curious, because my background, I was an archaeologist. I depended on that development, because most of our work was based on a right. developer taking over a property either in the eastern Everglades or in downtown, and had plans to, you know, sadly demolish and destruction. Archaeology is a very destructive science. So we were dependent on them to get information, to learn our history and do those investigations. But over the years, I have seen an effort, not only by local ordinance in the county and the city, but by people rising and actually wanting to have a say about saving buildings, saving historic sites. And that, of course, started in 1998 when we worked on the Miami Circle.
Many of our listeners may not have been there then. Give us a background of the Circle and an update on it.
Sure. So the Miami Circle became a famous archaeological site, and one of the first sites to really be preserved out here in South Florida back in 1998.
It was right at the mouth of the river.
Right, on the south bank of the mouth of the river. There was an archaeological site that was discovered right before a large condo project went up. And so archaeologists were investigating, and right before, on a Super Bowl Sunday, I remember, right before the builders came in the next day on that Monday, a judge, actually Data Heritage Trust, some other organizations, had a judge stop the construction, because right before, a few weeks before that, we had discovered a circular feature carved into the limestone bedrock.
Human-made.
Man-made circular feature, and we discovered, and it was probably the footprint, the footers to hold, a foundation to hold a circular structure. So that created a whole controversy with preservationists versus developers,
right.
Like what's going to happen to this incredible site. And we had incredible coverage from Good Morning America and 60 Minutes, and other reporters from across the nation came down here, along with local coverage, that really boosted that site to the national forefront. And here's a major 2,000-year-old archaeological site that all of a sudden is in Miami, right in the middle of downtown Miami. And it became an incredible story, really, on just how it was preserved. And that site is still there. You know, there's a park that's open to the public. The circular feature is covered due to preservation concerns. But there's interpretive materials out there. There's an audio tour you can go visit. And it really tells you about the early Tequesta Indians and the people that lived there all the way through the trading post that was there from the Brickells. And the site being protected for thousands of years.
I heard you also take pieces of buildings now that are being demolished and put them in the museum.
So we try to. We have a few, but there are local efforts by some preservationists to really save some of these structures that are being demolished. And they can't save the entire building. Maybe some decorative features or elements that are important. So we do look forward to helping with that cause. There's also signage and neon signs and other pieces of those buildings that could be saved to tell the story of the business.
Right. We're speaking with the director and CEO of History Miami Museum, George Zamanillo, and we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones and the email. Stay with us.
And we return 21 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and George Zamanillo. We're talking about, of course, the History Miami Museum in downtown Miami's Cultural Center and the many facets of that museum. How does the museum's top administration affect the focus of what is history and what should be preserved?
That's a good question, and something we take seriously when we do our planning for the, and try to come up with a new...
And it's board as well.
Right. And the new mission and vision of the museum, where we want to be. So that's a discussion that, like I said, is taken seriously with our staff and with our board members. We need to be reflective on what's going on in the community, stay relevant. There's other, you know, like with competition and other people in the community, other museums, we got to make sure that we're staying relevant and produce and come up with a product that people want to see, with a product that people want to... They want to come to the museum. They want to donate. They want to give their objects or artifacts or photos, whatever it may be, because they feel that history is important. We're viewed as the authority on history. So we need to make sure that that product is excellent.
When you expanded, what are your greatest sources of funding? And is it more of a challenge now, the funding, since you've expanded?
Right. So our costs always go up every year. But we're very limited funding. We're strong support from Miami-Dade County. And we win a lot from grants. We write grants. We have some support from the state of Florida through grants. But the rest is gate admissions and donors.
And the tours. And
right.
And
we
do you have revenue. Plans with other cultural organizations and even museums so that you can package memberships together?
We don't right now. We used to have one on the plaza when the art museum was next to us. But right now we're on our own. We do offer some reciprocal programs through some national organizations. American Alliance of Museums and some other groups. We have a Bank of America free weekend where we offer a partnership through that partnership is free admission. So there are various ways that we do that already.
What is the membership roughly?
So it ranges anywhere from $50 for individual to $75 for family.
The numbers of people.
Oh, a couple thousand members.
So you're always looking for new members, new sponsors.
We're always looking for sponsorships. That's a key to us. So whenever a new program or exhibition is coming up, we try to form those partnerships. And it's not only about the money. It's about really helping them tell their story. For instance, we have a big Hurricane Andrew exhibit coming up in June.
And June 1st.
Right, June 1st. It opens to the public that night. And there's some relationships there that I'm sure everybody assumes are going to be natural, right? FPL or State Farm or whoever it may be. They might come in and tell their story, how they helped rebuild the community after Hurricane Andrew, and especially in South Dade. And also help us tell a story.
And Brian Norcross is what, curating that exhibit?
Brian Norcross is our guest curator for Hurricane Andrew.
Great news. Good person to have, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. He is a person that carried us through the storm, and everyone remembers his name.
Absolutely. We've had him on a number of times, and people still call up and say, you know, thank you, Brian, for getting us through, you know.
And he loves history.
What are some of the other popular aspects of the museum, not necessarily in-house? Such as the walking tours, the boat bikes, the Paul George.
Sure. One of our more popular programs, like we mentioned, is Dr. George. You know, Dr. Paul George is our resident historian, and he conducts most of our walking tours and coach tours throughout the city, and he's in high demand.
And I see he's also going to be on a cruise, the Moon Over Miami River cruise with Dr. George. That's soon, actually, March 12th.
Yep, the March 12th, and that's very popular. Most people know the Miami River, and they see the businesses that are occupied from the street side, but once you get on the water and navigate west, and you see what's really going on and all new things popping up along the river, it's amazing. Right,
yeah. So that's this Sunday.
Yes.
At 8 p.m.
We have Dr. George on the line.
Oh, okay, what a good timing.
Of course, we know him from our many, many history quizzes. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Joe. How you doing?
Good.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hey, how are you, Paul?
Good, thank you. Good. Listening with great interest. George is doing a great job. And the museum, and I was thinking when I was listening to the early part of the show today, where one of George's predecessors, Randy Nimnick, who was director for and CEO for about 26 years, he once said in the late 90s, we got to take this great machine we have and bring it out into the community. And I was listening to George's remarks, and it's exactly what's been going on. You know, we've got that second museum building. We've got the tours. George had mentioned the archaeological element of the museum, the photography. We are out in this community in so many different ways now, as well as what we have inside the museum for people to come in and take advantage of that. what Randy had said a quarter of a century ago or less is really come true, and it's just really exciting to be with History of Miami. And I've been with him forever.
You have. Historian.
Yes, I have.
Actually,
I have.
You're one of the artifacts, Paul.
They're going to have, Madame Tussauds going to do a wax figure of you.
Exactly. No, but, you're not. But you're not that old.
No, but it's been a great run. It really has been.
I was thinking it would have been great if we had had a question to stump you. I didn't know you were going to call.
Hey, listen, we've done 50-plus of those shows, and you've always introduced me as History of Miami. So, I mean, you know, we're going to do it again. Maybe you can stump you the next time we do it.
Yeah, we haven't stopped those yet.
All right.
No.
Well, you just did a Little Havana Art and Culture Walk, but you are doing that Moon Over Miami River cruise. That's Sunday
Absolutely,
night.
Absolutely, this Sunday
6.
Evening. I'm very excited about it. I'm always excited about doing the river or the bay or whatever, and it's going to be a lot of fun. You know, the river is so fantastic, and George knows this as an archaeologist and as part of the museum, but it's bracketed by these really historical communities that very few people know about because, you know, so much of our population is out in the suburban areas. But, you know, you've got Spring Garden, Grove Park, Sewell Park. I mean, these are unbelievable places. And you see it. You not only see the river close up, but you see these great old communities, some of which go back over 100 years. So that tour is, it's always been an eye-opener, I think, for people that take the tour.
And if people want to take the tour, what do they do?
They can call... they can call the Education Department at 305-375-1621 or just go to online city tours at historyofmiami.org.
They can
list it there.
I wonder how many thousands of people have been introduced to downtown Miami and also Fort Lauderdale and all the other tours from Paul George. It's you can't even fathom the number of people.
A lot.
Are they developing there, Paul, where the cruise is going to go? Is there a lot of development underway?
Well, there's a lot of commercial development. They're taking, for example, an old boathouse that used to be Anchor Marine and converting that, if they get the clearance for it, into a restaurant and bar. Yeah. They've opened a couple of new restaurants and clubs just in the last couple of years on the river. They have plans for so much. You can't believe what's going on. Huh. The river finally is becoming what it should have been a long time ago. You know, a great venue for so many different things. As it is, you got a lot of diverse businesses on the river. It's a working river.
It's the fourth. It's the fourth largest port in Florida.
Yes, it is. It's $4 billion a year in trade alone. And that's in the Caribbean and Central and South America.
Our number, if you want to call in, if you want to either talk to George Zamanio or Paul George, if you can stay for a while.
Can you stay a while, Paul? I know you're busy.
Sure.
Our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Our email is radio@wlrn.org. What's this that each February, History Miami hosts the annual Miami International Map Fair? It's the largest map fair in the Western Hemisphere.
That was my next question.
Oh, okay. What is that?
It is a great event. And, you know, next February, we're going to celebrate the 25th anniversary of that fair.
I remember when they started that, and I was kind of scratching my head.
Yeah, what?
No, this thing is great. This year, we had over 36 vendors, and they show up from all over the world with their crafts, their maps, their vintage maps. Everything from a $5 map to a $1 million map, and they're for sale. And people trade and buy, and you could submit your maps for appraisal. So it's an incredible event over 2 days, and people love it, let me tell you.
I guess there's a great attraction to, what are they? They're antique?
Yeah, like I said, their maps are ranged anywhere from 500 years old to recent, smaller pictorial maps.
You can get prints of them.
No, you can buy the real. It's all the real thing. Yeah, you can buy the real maps there and trade for them, and there's a big market for this. But it's also a lesson in history. You let you browse through stacks of maps. You can see wherever you were born or wherever you visited, and you can see the original map of Florida or Cuba, the Caribbean, and compare it to a recent one. So it's hands-on history.
Don't they have something like that at the book fair as well?
They used to have an antiquarian section there, right? Some antique books. This is strictly maps.
Just I think they had something with
this. Some, right.
Our number, 1-800. We had some callers, but Richard's kind of busy on the phone, so you can call back. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. Again, we're speaking with History Miami Museum Director and CEO George Zamanio, along with Dr. Paul George. He is the resident historian of History Miami. We'll be right back.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, George Zamanio, and also Dr. Paul George. We're talking about History Miami this afternoon on the program. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question about the museum, you're certainly welcome. That's 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email radio@WLRN.org. Tell me more about the museum and maintaining the architectural unique aspects of South Florida architecture. Recently, you had the Alfred Browning Parker exhibit. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that was a great show. You know, Alfred Browning Parker did a lot of his work here throughout the 60s and 70s.
A lot in Coconut Grove.
Many houses in Coconut Grove and Coral Gables. Some of them are still standing. And we had a couple of guest curators, Randy Henning and Alan Shulman, local Alan Shulman, which is, of course, a local architect. And they did an incredible job. They borrowed materials from the University of Florida libraries and from the family and some other sources. And we transformed that gallery into everything you wanted to know about local architecture. It was amazing. You know, some of his early homes are really some of his first small home concepts, you know, the one-room homes. But the key thing was that he built with the environment. These are all mostly wooden structures on the outside, built into the setting, the natural setting, kind of like tree houses, and beautiful homes. Some of them were real small. Some later homes were much larger. And then we did a couple tours that went along with that exhibition, and we got to visit some of these sites.
Have the wooden, well, the wooden homes.
What's one of the challenges with those homes, right? The upkeep. It's not like a typical house where you can stucco and paint.
Right.
Some of them do have that, but a lot of them do have these wooden elements that need to be preserved. So that is quite a challenge, you know.
Let's take a call or two. We've got Gaston, is that correct, in Miami? Hi.
Hi, Gaston, either or. I had a question for the exhibit of Andrew, the art exhibit, the Andrew exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
And my question was, like, how does one come to, you know, what's it called, how do I ask the question? Like submit photos to the artist.
Oh, for inclusion.
Yeah.
Great. You could definitely reach out to me at the museums. We have a team working on the exhibition, and we've been reaching out to the community. We're going to do a series of interviews documenting people's stories before and after the storm and during the rebuilding effort. But a lot of it is going to be photographs from our collection and other people in the community. And any objects you may have. So let me know if you do have something. We would love to talk to you.
You know, we did thanks for your call, Gaston, a series of about a year that I produced called Care Force Radio, of interviews with people about their insurance. And we had psychiatrists on and people talking about, some of them were sitting on the ruins of their home and listening to the radio. It was some really powerful things there.
Yeah, you know, and we're commemorating the 25th anniversary of Hurricane Andrew. That's why we're doing it this year. But it really is about commemorating and remembrance.
Yeah. And we'll move along to another caller. We've got Peter in Coral Gables. You're still there, Paul, right? Oh.
Yes, hello.
Oh, Peter, go ahead.
Yes, I have a question for the director. I remember the old facility used to have a gift shop in it. And you could peruse a lot of material. Sometimes when you had an event there, you would host some of the specific material relative to the event and get an opportunity to purchase some of it, which obviously is a revenue stream that I would hope would come back. And I was just curious if the director could enlighten the listening audience with reference to that possibility. And I'll take my answer off the air, Mr. Cooper.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, the gift shop, the store, is definitely something we're going to revisit over the next year. There are different ways to approach that. One thing we're thinking is more of a topical, thematic approach to it, with a kiosk or pop-up store concept. So we're having an exhibit, let's say, on the Beatles we did last year, Sinatra. There will be materials and merchandise aligned with that.
But it will something will be coming.
We'll definitely need to be back. You know, just like this caller had a comment about it. We get many comments about
this. It's definitely a revenue stream that you will want to address.
Yeah, it is a limited revenue stream, but it's more about an expectation and people want to see certain things at a museum. So I understand that.
Alfredo wants us to repeat the information on where to go to get tickets for the boat tour. What you do, Alfredo, I just did it. You go to historymiami.org, and it's the first thing that pops up. Or you go to historymiami.org/citytours, and you'll find it. Okay? So that's for you, Alfredo. And again, that number, 305-375-1621, but it's easier just to do it online.
Yes.
And another call. We've got Ricardo in Miami. Hi. Ricardo.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. I would like to ask a question to Dr. George, please. It would be concerning Las Brisas, the property acquired by Ransom Everglades, which is a beautiful property. And then it is one and two questions. And then El Jardin.
Is he with us, Joe?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm still here, huh?
Okay.
Okay, Dr. George. If you could give us some information, we just acquired the property right next to Ransom Everglades School, which is Las Brisas, and that's a beautiful property. It is for the preservation of the environment. And then El Jardin, what you could tell us about those two beautiful properties, which are two schools nowadays. Thank you so much. And I'll see you soon.
You're putting me to work, Ricardo.
Ransom Everglades is the oldest, right?
Well, yes. It goes back to 1896, the school. And it's interesting because La Brisa was a property where some gentlemen were running a Kunti starch mill in the 1850s, and two of them were killed.
Oh, Kunti.
Were killed during the Third Seminole War.
Paul was raised on Kunti himself here.
Yeah. And then in 1921, a wealthy Pittsburgh lawyer, a man named John Semple, had this beautiful Spanish colonial home built there that's still around, of course. And that's the beginning of La Brisa as a development area. But I actually failed to mention the fact that before that, Kirk Monroe, who was a preeminent writer of boys' stories, he and his wife, Mary Barr Monroe, lived on that site. So you talk about history. And I know that Ransom Everglades recently picked up that site for what we would consider an astronomical fee, but actually I think they got a pretty good deal on it. And so it's now will become part of the school complex. So that's something. Now, El Jardin's interesting also, and it has some similarities to it. A man named John Binley, who was president of Pittsburgh Steel, built that great estate. And it was designed by the same people that designed La Brisa, that is Keenel and Ellie. Richard Keenel was a German architect, and they were out of Pittsburgh, but they came down to Miami, and that was the first commission that Keenel had, was to design El Jardin, which is today, of course, the Carrollton School for Girls. So you've got two of the most fantastic private homes, estates in greater Miami within a few blocks of one another, and I think it's really outstanding. And both have histories that go back in the case of La Brisa, go back to the 19th century. In the case of El Jardin, go back to the early 20th century.
Okay.
Okay. We are putting you to work.
That's great. Wow.
And we'll move along. Another caller, Stan in Kendall. Stan, hi.
Good afternoon. For the last several years, I have not been able to afford membership. I'm a retired senior in South Florida back in the... Well, let me tell you this. I go back to the History Museum of Southern Florida and the Caribbean when it used to be on the bay at around 20th Street and just off of 20th Street and Biscayne Boulevard. David Alexander, who was the director of the museum there, used to go into my father's shop, Sidney Smith Rare Coins, 25th and Biscayne. Yeah. When I came back from living in the Bahamas for several years, I was a member. I had a sponsorship, was a member, and as long as business was good, it was terrific. I will tell you, business went sour, a couple things happened, and it's not your problem. But in the last 2 years, I have made repeated inquiries with membership at History Miami and suggested, can we set up something like WLRN's Friends, the sustaining memberships, where I can pay $7, $8, $10 a month, whatever, and get a family membership for two people. And I'm sorry, we don't offer it, and that's the only response I get. I'll be honest with you. It's frustration for me. I think it is a terrible waste of more people that you could get interested and involved in the museum. People that are older, have memories of old Miami and South Florida, who would be a good asset. And somehow, y'all are missing the boat.
I'm okay. George. I'm sure George is familiar with this. Yeah. Tell us.
Well, I wrote, actually wrote George a letter, and I didn't get a response, but it may not have gotten to him. I used the email addresses that I had.
Okay, George, what do you want to...
Stan, I hear your concerns. What I'll do is I'll personally make sure that we look into our membership department, see what we can offer you. There are many ways to engage with the museum, including a lot of free programming that we do, where you can get a lot of our resources, basically for free. But please do give me a call, reach out to me, and I'll make sure that we address those concerns.
Okay. And the number where I get you at would be?
375-1492.
And again, your last name?
Zamanio.
Zamanio. Terrific. Thank you very much.
Okay, Stan.
Thank you. I look forward to it. Cool.
I have a question, George Zamanio. Whenever I'm in the museum and I see what's out front and being displayed, and of course the great displays that are always there, is how much is behind the scenes? What percent is out front versus what percent is held in abeyance?
Well, most museums in general only exhibit about 3-4% of their collections, and that's mostly true for us. I think we do a little higher, about 5 or 6%. But if you count every little object that we have in storage,
it's a lot.
Or downstairs in collections, or an offsite facility,
it'd be so interesting to be millions. Able to roam around those areas.
It's millions, and we do offer opportunities for that. We have tours that we offer to our offsite storage collections once in a while for certain members, or we open up to the public. I'll give a private tour of our object collection or our archive center once in a while, and people love seeing what's behind the scenes, right? And we'll highlight some of the objects there. But the great thing about it is that we rotate. So it's not only the things you see on display
right.
now,
right.
we're constantly rotating what we have on display.
How big is your permanent collection?
Oh, our photographs alone are probably over 2 million, 1.5 to 2 million photos. And then our objects, so everything else, we have maps and books. But the rest of the object collection, that's close to 30,000 or 40,000 pieces there. And that's not even counting every little bone or piece of bone or pottery from an archaeological site. That's just in bulk.
It's staggering.
It's so neat that you were both, both an archaeologist first and got to touch some of those bones. And now you're the curator, and now you're the director.
It helps because I know what the process is to receive a piece, catalog it, photograph it, document it, do the research on it, and then find a place where it could live, right, either on exhibit or in storage. And make sure they get rotated. So it's a lot more work than most people probably know and don't need to know.
Right.
What it costs to save one piece.
We're speaking with the director and CEO of History Miami Museum, George Zamanio. We're going to take our last break. We'll be right back. Stay with us, Paul, George, and our caller there, and we'll be right back.
And we're back 47 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're on the History Beat today with George Zamanio of History Miami and the resident historian of History Miami. Of course, our own Dr. Paul George is with us. And we have some calls. We have some lines open, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Also, quick email, radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. And we'll go to the next caller, Yvonne in Miami. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Hi. I was born in Miami in 1943. I'm still here. Wouldn't live anywhere else. My home sweet home. But I just wanted to call and say how much I appreciate people preserving the history of Miami. I really haven't been too much involved, but probably will be. I just love it here. So I was just calling to say, I can remember when I was born here, I can remember where Northwest 79th Street was basically the end of Miami, right at 7th Avenue. So it's been a long time. I recently wrote a book, or writing a book of my life, trying to remember everything from when I was a child.
You may have to consult with Dr. George on that. Yes, he can fill in the blanks for you.
Well, I remember a lot of being a child here and, downtown Miami and taking the bus to the beach and all that kind of stuff. It's just, I love it here. I wouldn't live anywhere else. Hmm. So I just wanted to say I appreciate what you're doing, and I will try to get more involved.
Okay, thanks for calling, Yvonne.
Thanks for
You're welcome.
And thanks, Yvonne. We love people with your passion. And let me know if you do come by the museum. I would love to show you around.
Some of the young people that come to work here at WLRN are surprised when I tell them that when I came here, I-95 had a grass median and wasn't completed through Broward County.
That's right.
Paul remembers those days.
Yes, indeed.
Are you there? Yes.
Yes, I am, huh?
So, Paul, let's talk about, well, first let's turn to George and talk about some of these other events before we run out of time. This Rewind Fast Forward Film Festival is part of the Memory Lab, but it's next Saturday. So explain what that is.
Yeah, so the Wilson Archives, Moving Picture Archives, had the Rewind Fast Forward Festival for years, and they're bringing it back this year and tying it in, reincarnating the film festival into the Memory Lab exhibition. And I got to tell you, that's one of the biggest treasures that we have in South Florida. If you've been to the Wilson Archives and spoken to Rene Ramos and Kevin and the people there, they have an incredible collection of footage going back, you know, hundreds of years, whatever, you know, how long it goes back.
Right.
But it's every time we need something, you know, we call them for an exhibit or for research, and they can find exactly what you need. They're incredible.
So this is Saturday the 18th, and it goes from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. It's all day. You can screen films. And then on the Sunday, the 19th, the screenings are going to run from 1 p.m. to 4:30 p.m.
Yeah, and the great thing is for all festival attendees, it's free admission to the museum.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we'll move along to George in Coconut Grove. George, you're up. Hi.
Yeah, hi. My name is George Simpson. My great-grandfather, he built a house at 3242 Charles Avenue, which we're currently renovating. He's Black. And that, I think, is the oldest private house that's in Miami. The Ransom House, the house on the Ransom Estate, was actually built after that. But in any case, we're currently renovating that building. And, well, if you know much about Coconut Grove, you'd know that my great-grandfather was the largest landowner. He became in Coconut Grove and owned over 400 properties when I was a youth, including we owned the land that the Coconut Grove Playhouse was on when I was 5 or 6, which we eventually sold to them. So anyway, I'm just saying this in terms of getting some things that were done. There are a number of things around Dade County that are named after either my grandfather or his son, which, again, was Frank Jr. So anyway, just adding that to the discussion. And as I said, we're currently renovating that property at 3242 Charles Avenue.
Paul George,
Paul,
your
are
thoughts?
You?
Yes. You know, History of Miami and myself, we offer a walk tour and a bus tour of Charles Avenue from the Playhouse and the Reverend Stirrup's house is just down the street.
Well, he wasn't a reverend. He was just a builder. But no, he wasn't a reverend. And again, our house is diagonally across the street from the Coconut Grove Playhouse.
Right. That one that's restored now.
No, well, right. The restoration is going on. Maybe we'll finish it.
You're right.
Summer. Yeah.
But he, so we walked down that street, and it's always been a wonderful, pleasurable walk. And it's a real surprise to people to see not only some of the original housing stock there, but to learn that sometimes third-generation family members are living in the same home as our forebears, and that's just
well,
unheard of.
Well, I think you would
like
be
this.
Closer to, say, fifth-generation families, because, again, I'm in my 60s, and my parents are in their 90s.
Wow.
They're both still living in Coconut Grove.
That's amazing.
Even they built their own house in 1953, so the house that I'm calling you from. So the point is that, you know, very often, unfortunately, the West Grove gets left out of a lot of these conversations. But if you're aware that when the Charter of Miami came in the late 1890s, it didn't have enough white people, so they allowed the Blacks to vote for one day. So there are many Black residents of the Grove who are actually on the city charter.
Oh,
my grandfather,
yes,
wouldn't sign because he said they only let Blacks vote for that one day.
Right.
And then that was it. So anyway, I'm just saying, just adding to the dialogue of what you're talking about in terms of
yeah, we appreciate that.
Miami,
well,
history.
Miami very much recognizes that street and its importance, and I love conducting tours down that street into the cemetery and just a lot of elements of that, the churches that we see along the route and everything else. We'll continue to do that, too.
Yeah, the cemetery is named after his wife, Charlotte Jane.
Right, Memorial
and,
Park,
yes. He was able to... he worked, you know, initially when he came to Miami, he worked as a regular laborer. But him and his wife, worked during the day as a maid. They were able to save enough money, and they bought a team of mules so that when they were building the railroad, and, of course, all of Miami was basically a swamp, Coconut Grove being the highest elevation. That's why everything was located in Coconut Grove, the city hall, the naval base, and later the Pan Am seaplane terminal. He was able to get contracts to clear land and not just be a regular worker. They would not pay him the same as the white contractors. So what he proposed was that they pay him half in land and half in cash. And that's how he accumulated the 400 or 500 properties.
George, we really appreciate you calling in.
Yeah,
with
George,
that
that's a great piece of history.
We're just about out of time, though. But thank you very
much. No problem.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
You too. And Ralph Morales from the Florida National Guard writes, he just wants to tell you, George Zamaneo, that he has a great staff and they've been incredibly valuable in their research of Miami military history and the American Legion.
Oh, thank you, Ralph. I appreciate that.
Paul George, we neglected to talk about the Southern Florida Historical Association 1940 vintage. I believe the president was George Merrick. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And I think Marjorie Douglas was on that committee as well.
Yeah, George Merrick wrote the first article in Tequesta, which was a 1941 number of Tequesta, and that's still ongoing, that journal. I serve as editor and have for 22 years. And he was one of the founders of it and the first leader of it, as you've indicated. Merrick was an amazing guy, you know, very well-lettered and a very courageous guy. He lost virtually everything when the boom went bust in the late 20s, and yet he hung in there and
wound up being the postman.
Yes, he became postmaster of Dade County, but what a story that is. But he was instrumental in the founding of what is today's History of Miami.
Well, we just want to go over again that Moon Over Miami with Dr. Paul George is
This Sunday,
yeah. And it's at 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock. I think they believe they meet over at Bayside, and then you get the boat from there. And also, one of my favorite tours, the Stiltsville and Key Biscayne tours, I believe there's one coming up Sunday, March 26th. And
it
that
is.
Was incredible.
Sunday, March 26th. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great one, too. We've got 7 homes in Stiltsville, and we looked and talked about each of them, you know, in a really detailed fashion. It's just a wonderful tour.
What boats do you go out on for these?
Well, we usually use the Island Queen, which is part of a fleet that's docked at Bayside. Sometimes we use the Pelican Harbor vessel, a smaller vessel of a smaller group. And, you know, both take us where we need to go, and it's really fascinating. And we get out there, and we're out in the wild blue, and you're in Biscayne Bay. It's beautiful.
Fun.
Well, more information is at historymiami.org. We want to thank Dr. Paul George, the resident historian of History Miami, longtime Miami-Dade professor, Miami-Dade College professor. Thank you, and feel better, Paul.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. Thanks. Appreciate it.
And with us, History Miami Museum Director and CEO George Zamaneo. During his 17-year tenure at History Miami, he has served as curator, vice president of expansion projects, deputy director, and director, and now he is director and CEO. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Okay. And that wraps up our program. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Today's program was produced by Polly Landis. Topical Currents lead producer is Richard Ives. Engineering support and online direction from Jason Zabka. And remember, it's easy to download or listen to free audio archives of each program from our website. That's WLRN.org. Topical Currents Facebook page also, and the iTunes podcast. Of course, tomorrow is Thursday. That means Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining segment. It's about creating your own family cookbooks rather easily as an ebook. We'll speak with Nancy Scanlon, who's created My Mother's Cookbook. Also, information about the Broward Humane Society's annual Walk for the Animals. It's a mile and a quarter, with or without a dog. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Here and Now is next from NPR News.